This is 928. I'm Daniel Crocker. Thanks for joining us tonight for this discussion about the recent wildfires that burned across northern Arizona, lessons we can take away from those fires, and things we can do as we move ahead to get our forests restored to prevent future catastrophic wildfires from occurring. Let's go to the phones. And caller, could you please identify yourself and tell us your name and where you're calling from? We're having some computer issues, but thanks for joining us.
Hi, my name is Anna Higgins from Flagstaff.
Thanks for calling.
And I'm just calling. I'm really excited about the Four Fry and where it's going, but I'm just curious as to where the funding's going to come for this, and also where are we going to get the loggers and the forest product industry to support this restoration project?
Great question. Ethan Amek.
Well, I can take a crack at that. One of the fundamental premises of the Four Fry is that we need industry involved in forest restoration to allow us to work at landscape scales. One participant in the process, Tommy Martin, a supervisor from Gila County, said once that the solution is in the market, not in the treasury. And I think that statement of hers has stuck. So we're really trying to do our best to find industries that are appropriately scaled that can use the byproducts of restoration without driving the restoration process. But use the byproducts of restoration, create jobs, create economic stimulus in our rural economies, and essentially drive down the cost of restoration treatments, which now run upwards of $1,000 per acre. And we can't do nearly as much as we need to do when those costs approach $1,000 an acre. So we are recruiting within the collaborative process industries that may be able to assist in this process. They will be bidding on contracts for available wood and biomass. And we're hopeful that we'll have industries that can work with the amount of material available at these large and new scales to help offset costs. And to be honest about it, this work will require some additional money from the federal government. And I think if we demonstrate the kind of efficiency we think we can in this project, we can attract that kind of additional funding from the federal government. But really, the primary solution here is in finding the right industries to participate in the process.
Wally Covington, something you told me when we chatted last week, I believe, was that there's only 2% of the industry that's needed to take care of all the wood that's out there?
Yeah. For the wood that needs to be removed over the next 40 years, if we were just use our existing industry, we'd only be using about 2% of the wood that needs to be removed. There's one other part of Anna's question I think that we should address is, where is the expertise going to come from? You know, I'm in the School of Forestry, and in doing science-based restoration, you don't just send a bunch of people out in the woods with a chainsaw and some matches. You know, you have to have people that are very well trained, and we've lost much of that expertise here. The number of employees that are engaged in this, quite a few. So there is going to be a training period. Fortunately, we have enough people left here in Arizona, New Mexico, and the Southwest in general, where we can set up training programs that can pretty rapidly train people in restoration techniques.
Let's go back to the phones. Doug is joining us from Flagstaff. Doug, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I've got a question. Would like to hear the panel discuss global climate change, projections of 3 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. And what does that mean for our ponderosa pine forest? And what then can you describe the concept of forest restoration within that context?
Great question, Doug. Wally Covington.
Yes, Doug, as far as global climate change is concerned, I think that everyone certainly sees the signs of that, and it's not just because it's so hot right now on the East Coast and here in the Southwest. But one of the concerns about global climate change is we do have quite a bit of uncertainty about it, about how it'll play out locally. One of them that's common is that it's going to be hotter and drier here in the Southwest, in the mountains of the Southwest. But there are valid projections that suggest that it's going to be hotter and wetter. So we don't know quite what's going on. One that everyone seems to agree on is that there are going to be much more severe weather conditions. But one of the premises of ecological restoration internationally is that in cases of uncertainty, the safest thing to do is to restore the self-regulatory mechanisms that ecosystems have that have developed over evolutionary time. And by restoring those self-regulating mechanisms, then the ecosystem should be able to adjust. So that's the how ecological restoration deals with it. Now, if you look at ponderous pine ecosystems over evolutionary time, they've experienced some very radical changes. During its when ponderous pine first shows up in the evolutionary record, carbon dioxide concentrations were about five times what they are today. So we know that they can grow well into the higher carbon dioxide concentrations. Researchers have shown that over the long sweep of evolutionary time, there have been very rapid changes, both very rapid changes in increased temperature and very rapid decreases in temperature. During all of these circumstances, these ecosystems have been able to self-regulate and maintain themselves, but they haven't been able to do it under the weak conditions they're in right now, where the forests are overchoked with trees, where there's not the intact, vibrant understory and soils that are supported by grassland understory vegetation and so on.
Doug, thanks for that question. 800-523-5628 is the number to call to join the conversation. You can also send us an email at knau@nau.edu. Rick is with us from Flagstaff. Rick, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Rick.
Hello.
Hi, Rick. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was thinking more in terms of this economy stuff. You know, I've worked to try to get permits to go get a lot of the dead standing wood out by Red Mountain in those areas, and I haven't gotten anywhere with the Forest Service to try to even get a decent response and wait for phone calls and talk to one person or another. But not to complain so much, what I'd like to say is, why not turn it more over to the private sector here? We got a lot of people that are willing to go to work and get out there and get things done, even if it is postcard piece. We'll be getting stuff done while everybody else is trying to figure out what to do.
Well,
that's about all I got to say about it.
Well, thanks for that call, Rick. And it does seem, gentlemen, that there is consensus that the private sector has to be involved if this is going to happen on a large scale.
Well, that's one of the premises behind the Four Fry Project is like Tommy Martin likes to say, the solution is in the economy, not in the treasury. And there was an earlier caller that asked, I think Anna asked, about how we were going to pay for this. Essentially, the Forest Service is going to pay for the planning of these processes. So that's all the environmental compliance. But we cannot afford to pay for all the treatments that are needed throughout the forest. That is something that we really need the economy to help us with. We don't know what that is. We have a request for information out right now, which we're trying to build a contract off of. And basically what that is we are asking the public, here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to restore 2.4 million acres of ponderosa pine forest, and we want to do that at $0 to the federal government. So tell us, how can you do that? And we don't know what that industry is at this point. We are working through that. We hope to have some good answers here in the next couple of years.
Ethan, go ahead.
Sure. I think one of the interesting characteristics of this discussion as it's changed over the last 10 years or so has been a very positive change in perception with respect to restoration-supporting industries and their involvement in restoration in the Southwest. I think there's been a common recognition that we can't do this without the private sector, that the private sector needs to be working at scale to use these restoration byproducts. The challenge is that we're working at scales that are daunting. And whether you want to look at the amount of wood, round wood, that's available as a function of restoration treatments or limbs and overall biomass, we've got a tremendous amount of material. So some of that can be used at smaller scales, and some of it is likely going to have to be used at larger scales. And everyone at the table now recognizes that. And one of our challenges and one of our opportunities moving forward is to figure out which industry or set of industries can use what is a very large amount of material and use that material in a supportive manner versus a manner that's driving inappropriately the restoration process.
Because this is, you know, I think a lot of people probably have sort of a more historical or stereotypical image of the timber industry and thinking of, you know, 2x4s and big tall trees and so forth. But this is a different kind of industry that folks are looking to lure here, right, to use the small diameter stuff.
Sure. It's and we don't have an industry or a set of industries that have secured a contract and are moving forward with the development of infrastructure to start processing wood and biomass. We have several viable candidates working in the collaborative process right now. One candidate is proposing to develop an oriented strandboard mill that would take that low-value material and essentially chip it up and reform it into construction panels. And we have other folks that have been advocates for biomass energy, and we have folks that are currently processing some of this wood in eastern Arizona into pellets. So this isn't the standard industry. This is far from the story we've been familiar with in the past about industry's role in forest management, forest restoration in particular. It's a very different story.
We do have phone lines open now if you want to join the conversation at 800-523-5628, or if you're in Flagstaff, it's 523-5628. Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Flagstaff. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us. Hi, Chris, are you there? Looks like we lost Chris. 800-523-5628. Again, is the phone number to call. You can also join us on Facebook or send us a tweet here at KNAU. We did get a question from Janelle from Facebook. She is curious about the trajectory of forest recovery from the Schultz fire and more generally how the ecosystem recovers from a crown fire as opposed to a more low-intensity ground fire. Anyone want to take that on? Wally?
Sure. You know, Janelle's question is a very good one. One of the things that is often hard for people to understand is what Henry was pointing out earlier, is that ponderosa pine ecosystems are adapted to low-intensity surface fires that don't kill the trees. Rather, they help thin out the excess tree regeneration that occurs, reinvigorate the grasses, and so on. Crown fires are fundamentally different. Whereas crown fires are natural in lodgepole pine forest and in spruce forest and so on, those ecosystems have experienced crown fires over evolutionary time and have mechanisms for recovery. Ponderosa pine ecosystems do not have good mechanisms for recovery after crown fire. So the trajectory for recovery after a crown fire in ponderosa pine is a very long trajectory on the scale of thousands of years, not the hundreds of years that you look at in a lodgepole pine forest. Now, in looking at what's going to happen to much of the area on the Schultz Creek fire, I think there are some good examples that people can look at. One of them is the Mount Eldon fire, the radio fire that we had in 1977. Much of the area of the Mount Eldon fire, the radio fire as we called it, it is still in scrub vegetation. It's made no progress in recovery toward forested areas. You can also look north of town at the Horseshoe Fire, the Pumpkin Fire, the Hockendorfer Hills fires, and those ecosystems, for the most part, are a far cry from recovery after 20, 30 years. So the outlook is not good for burned over areas. And when you look at this, it's sort of a medical analogy somehow sometimes useful, is that it's much easier to prevent disease than it is to try to treat disease. And that's what we're trying to do here with restoration, is we're trying to take a preventative approach, is to get the ecosystems in good health so that when fires occur or if global climate change occurs, that the ecosystems will be able to deal with it on their own without investment of hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars per acre.
Henry.
Yeah, that's a great point. That medical analogy is a great point. I mean, I think what we're seeing are the symptoms rather than the disease, and we need to focus on the disease. And clearly, that's our unhealthy ecosystems, which are well overstocked. And I think that's where we need to focus our efforts.
800-523-5628. Again, the number to join the conversation, 523-5628 if you're in Flagstaff. Let's go to Stuart, who's calling from Cordis Junction. Stuart, thanks a lot for calling in.
Hi. I was wondering in what plans you'd have to repopulate the forest, or not necessarily repopulate it, but to correct the lack of age diversity that seems to be that prevalent in large portions of the forest. For instance, since the logging industry, there seems to be a lot of forest that one can see from the road and even driving some of the back roads. That's all the same virtual age groups, like virtually all middle-aged trees and virtually all young trees.
Stuart, great question. I'm going to interrupt you for a second just because your connection is bad, but Henry Provincia with the Forest Service, a question on the diversity of the forest and the age of the trees.
That's a great question, Stuart, and that's clearly one that we recognize. We clearly recognize that we largely have a homogeneous forest out there. The bulk of our trees are 12 to, say, 18 inches in diameter, and those are clearly the ones that we would focus the bulk of our efforts on. Looking at restoration, we want to have a diversity of age classes and size classes. Now, there's not a lot we can do immediately after treatment as far as age class. All we can do is set the trajectory for those forests to recover or to be restored in a manner that that will reflect greater age diversity and size class diversity. But essentially, we're just dealing with what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I guess, Henry, one of the things, restoration really is an investment in the future, and it's really for future generations. You can't grow a 400-year-old tree in less than 400 years. You can't do it in 100 years. But one thing that all of our restoration treatments seek to do is to protect the remaining old-growth trees and to assure that we have sufficient trees that can grow into those age classes over the next 200, 300 years. So that's what it's about right now, is that as Henry's saying, is set them on a trajectory so that in the future we'll have a natural self-regulating ecosystem that is an asset instead of a liability to people that live near it.
Is there a consensus among environmental groups, the Forest Service, timber companies, in general, to keep the biggest trees and thin out the smaller trees?
Well, there is a very significant consensus around a great majority of the issues we're dealing with in planning landscape scale restoration. There definitely is consensus around protecting old growth trees. There's been historically some additional debate about large trees that aren't necessarily old growth and what to do with those large trees. They're fairly a small component of the overall system compared to the massive number of smaller trees we have across the landscape. But they do consume a significant amount of our attention in terms of what to do with those some of those larger trees in a restoration context. So in the context of the Four Forest Restoration Initiative, we as a group have agreed on a process for coming together and using best available science and working through the hard issues and finding agreement around those hard issues, one of which is in certain places what to do with the larger trees. And I think I'm very optimistic that we have enough agreement that we can really cross the starting line, so to speak, and get a plan across that first 750,000 acres that everyone agrees to. So we're never going to have complete consensus on every issue. The question is, can we have enough agreement moving forward to allow these very ambitious efforts to be viable socially, politically, legally, et cetera? And I am very confident that we have enough agreement to make this project viable in all of those respects.
That's Ethan Amack with the Grand Canyon Trust also joining us this evening, Wally Covington with NAU's Ecological Restoration Institute, and Henry Provincia with the Coconino National Forest. We need to take a quick break. Chris from Flagstaff, thanks for holding on. We'll get to your call right after the break. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-523-5628. This is 928 on KNAU, Arizona Public Radio.